Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Bloomberg Business Week Weekend Podcast. Well, a lot going on. And this week we found ourselves at Schwab Impact 2023. It's a gathering of investment professionals catering to the advisory world in Philadelphia. So we were really surrounded by registered investment advisors trying to assess today's market environment as geopolitical conflicts and global economic uncertainty just seemed to be deepening. It was such a great environment to be dropped into with so much going on and trying to figure out the way forward for the world broadly, but certainly for the investment world.
Carol, it was also the biggest earnings week of the quarter now behind us as we saw nearly 40% of S&P 500 companies report. And ahead this hour, we're going to talk to a pair of CEOs about their latest results and what they tell us about the health of the American consumer. We're going to talk to the heads of Mattel and Whirlpool in just a few minutes.
Before we get there, we do want to start with a look at what's going on in Israel, Gaza, and in Europe as well. The war between Israel and Hamas is now into its fourth week, while the war in Ukraine is now a staggering 20 months old. And our first guest helps us understand the historical significance of what is playing out overseas.
Ed Price is a former British trade official who represented the UK government to Wall Street, who has also now advised members of the European and British parliaments, and who now serves as principal for geopolitical forecasting at Ergo. It's a global intelligence consulting and forecasting firm, and it correctly predicted a Russian invasion back in early 2022. We spoke with him Monday from New York.
I've been thinking about the First World War. And whenever you study the First World War, of course, you have to remember that people were surprised and that the alliances that were underpinning the relationships between states were invisible before 1914, before the conflict began, but then very rapidly became clear. And so what I'm thinking about is, what are the alliances, what are the fault lines between powers? And if you go around your mental map of the Middle East, Israel is in a bit of a pickle, right? You've got Oman and Yemen. I don't think that they're friendly. You've got Lebanon, you've got Syria, you've got above that Turkey, who knows what they'll do in this situation. They don't seem like they want to do anything to offend wider Muslim opinion. You've got Saudi Arabia now, which of course has said that it's not going to do this deal, or we hear that it might not want to do this deal with Israel. And then of course, behind everything, Iran.
So what's the question with Iran? I mean, how does the US navigate that?
US has to look at Iran now as essentially a franchise of Russia. Because the way that the Iranians have timed their support for Hamas, and who knows, also possibly Hezbollah, can only be something that benefits Putin and the Kremlin and their endeavors in Ukraine. I mean, let's look at this rationally. All of our attention has shifted away from the European theater to the theater in the Middle East. And whilst I can't prove any collaboration between Russia and Iran, I would bet my bottom dollar that there is one.
I want to go to this piece you did in Barron's, which you've touched on some of this, but this idea of this democracy trap. And talk to us a little bit about it, because it sounds like what happens is then we kind of really do miss either the development of certain strategic alliances, and it can obviously run afoul, as maybe we're already seeing as it's played out in this world in maybe the last couple of years or so.
Well, you know me, Carol. I'm always desperately seeking some sort of analytical fame. I make furtive efforts at catchy articles and titles and so on. The democracy trap is simply the idea that you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't when you're a democracy. If you do not punish your enemies in a way that other empires and other autocracies in the past have shown is effective, then you are, on the one hand, maintaining your morality as a democracy, but on the other hand, you're letting them go. You're letting them get away with things. And flip that around. If democracies do go ahead and apply firepower to their blood enemies, people turn around, as I said before, and say, well, what kind of democracy are you if you don't care about human rights? And I'm afraid we've now tangled ourselves up as the West, as democracies more generally, into a position, and perhaps this is a legacy of the Vietnam War, perhaps it's a legacy of the Afghanistan War, I don't know, but we don't seem willing to really hit our enemies hard. Now, that's a problem, because at some point we're going to have to, and very unfortunately, it appears that the next time that we're going to have to will be Hamas. Hamas has embedded itself in a civilian population. Mm-hmm. Some of those people support Hamas, a lot of them don't, and half of them are children. So again, let's go back to Putin. He would like nothing more than to see Israel, the US, the UK, and others, whether in reality or in perception, doing things that he is doing in Ukraine so that he can point to us and say, there's no difference.
So here I want to take the step of, you know, some of your past history where you represented the UK government to Wall Street and the US. And I think about, Ed, the tricky relationship of global companies to China, to the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, right? We know the atrocities that have happened. And yet we continue to do business. And I understand the thinking of, well, if we're involved, we can help make things better. Okay. But that doesn't often happen. So I'm thinking about our investment audience who are listening to you. And I'm just thinking, okay, so are companies doing what they should be in terms of standing up for democracy if we really believe in it? Or will they never, because they have business interests in so many of these difficult regions of the world?
Well, I don't know if they will or not ever, but right now, no, they're not. And sometimes I scratch my head in the wee hours when I think about the blood, sweat, and tears that's gone into ESG. Mm-hmm. And wonder, to your point, Carol, about where the equivalent is for human rights and democracy. I mean, human rights and democracy scores, right? We have that around the edges. We have a sort of center-left tradition of protest in some Western countries. We have Amnesty International. A lot of business leaders themselves, regardless of their politics, are upright, have integrity, and want to do the right thing. But we are exposed to countries that mistreat their populations. We purchase things that were, possibly made in circumstances that we shouldn't really accept. That's the old Naomi Klein book, No Logo. But moving on from that, we now know about the Uyghurs and other egregious human rights issues in the world. But look, it's very difficult. I mean, if we've got, for example, Western financial services positively exposed to Chinese growth, if we've got other firms in the world, I mean, look at semiconductors that are essentially just trying to do business to keep the modern economy running, I imagine that they're hoping that the international geopolitical outlook will calm down somehow. My fear is that it won't, Carol.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a valid fear given what we're seeing, Carol.
Yeah, it feels like it's just going to get worse. Like when you talk about, you know, some similarities from the first war, World War, like I just think we're just at this very, what, go ahead, Tim.
Well, I was just going to say, just to piggyback on that, Carol, I mean, Ed, it seems like the U.S., you know, some people would argue that the U.S. is engaged in a proxy war with Russia. I've heard that. And again, not necessarily my view, but I've heard that argument. And then I've heard the argument, too, that the U.S. is finding itself drawn into this latest conflict in the Middle East by actually having a carrier, or a military presence there just off the coast.
Right, Tim. Right you are. So maybe we should be talking about Bush, right? And both Bushes.
Good point.
Because Gulf War III may be just around the corner.
Do you believe that, though? Are you being facetious, or do you believe that?
Yeah.
I'm not being facetious at all. No, I'm sitting here on your radio show. I think that that's absolutely possible. I'm very concerned. And, you have to be careful with these things, because like I said in these articles, if you're someone who worries, then you're going to get accused of crying wolf, and rightly so, if, you know, if things don't go the way that they look, they might be going. But let's play it out quickly. You know, Israel goes into Gaza. Hezbollah thrusts into the north. There's a second, third, fourth, sixth, whatever intifada it is in the West Bank. At the same time, Iran decides now's a good time for some sort of global activation of any terror networks they have. Bob's your uncle, right? Immediately, you've got to get the only real cop in town, the only real cop in the world, which is the United States, involved somehow in the Middle East. Now, again, if I was an adversary of the United States, I'd be thinking, well, all I need to do is a third one someplace, and, you know, I can go and take Taiwan.
That was Ed Price. He's principal of geopolitical forecasting at Ergo.
As we mentioned, and as you can probably hear from the background, this week we broadcast from the Schwab Impact 2023 conference in Philadelphia. Coming up, investors juggling geopolitics with earnings this week. And on that front, we talk quarterly results with the CEO of Mattel, Ynon Kreiz, who also had some thoughts about his native Israel.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
All right, everybody. As promised, we do have the Mattel CEO, Ynon Kreiz, joining us from El Segundo, California on Zoom. Ynon, let's get Barbie, because I bet she could fix Zoom. Don't you think so? How are you?
Hi, Carol. Hi, Tim. Great to be with you.
It's so great to be with you. I feel like I have a million questions. I feel like I want to go to a bar, have a drink with you, and just sit and talk. I want to start with the Israel-Hamas conflict. You're born in Israel, studied at Tel Aviv University before heading to the West Coast of the United States of America. I hope your family and friends are safe. I pray that they are safe. How are you thinking about all of this right now and this conflict? And is there a way to peace in that region?
Yeah, thank you for asking. My family is okay. My immediate family is okay. But, and you know, of course, as an Israeli, this is a very personal to me. And I know too many people who lost loved ones or have relatives that have been kidnapped and are now being held hostage in Gaza. You know, on behalf of Mattel, we condemn the terrorism and atrocities perpetrated by Hamas and stand against hate and violence in all forms. We express hope for the safety of Israelis and Palestinian children and families caught in the Israeli-Hamas war. As a company, since the Hamas attacks on October 7th, the Mattel Children's Foundation has been focused on humanitarian work, including cash and toy donations to shelters and hospitals to support children who are suffering. And we're sitting here all wishing for a swift resolution to the war and more peaceful times in the future.
Well, Ynon, it's something that, you know, people who are, wow, gosh, I mean, up to 80 years old at this point, have dealt with their entire lives in that area of the world. And I'm wondering to you, and not speaking on behalf of Mattel, but just getting your thoughts personally, how this ends, if a two-state outcome is the only solution to ending the conflict there once and for all.
You know, it's a complicated conflict, and we're now sitting at a time that is very volatile. We see risk of escalation, and we just hope for a swift resolution and wishing peace for everybody as soon as we can.
I want to talk about Mattel. I have one more question for you. Do you think Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is not going to be the leader that brings lasting peace?
Yeah, this is not the time to get into the political discussion. Right now, everyone is focused on resolving the situation. Israel articulated its priorities. We're all really looking forward for the release of the hostages. There are 30 children under the age of 16 that are being held captive right now. About half the hostages are women, and we really believe that this should be resolved as soon as possible, and we pray for the release, safety and release of all the hostages that are now being held captive.
You are absolutely right. But we do appreciate you weighing in on this, because we have talked to you about serious issues in the past. So really appreciate this. No easy segue, but I do want to talk about the business of Mattel. Talk to us about last quarter and the outlook. It was a tough day in the equity market for you guys. You did talk about tougher industry conditions. What are those tougher industry conditions that you guys are worried about?
Well, we did see the industry being soft in the third quarter and year to date, and as a result, we adjusted our expectation and believe the industry will decline mid-single digit for the full year. But don't you need to remember that this is after the industry was up 22% from 2019 to 2022, reaching an all-time high. So coming off after such a strong increase, especially in a challenging macroeconomic environment, we believe that this is a reasonable situation and doesn't reflect on the strength and resilience of the industry long term. The toy industry has been growing for over 10 years, and it's a growth category. So we feel very good about the industry and its growth prospects. And even in that environment, even in a softer market, Mattel performed very strongly. Our quarterly results exceeded expectations. We showed meaningful sales growth and margin expansion with very strong free cash flow in the quarter. Mm-hmm. We saw consumer demand increasing, and we continue to outpace the industry.
I think a lot of investors today, at least sending shares down about 7%, were concerned that you guys maintained your full year sales outlook despite all of the success of the Barbie movie. So what would have to happen, Enon, to bring in more than the $125 million expected from the Barbie movie and related products? What needs to happen at Mattel or in the industry for that to happen? Or for the consumer, I should say.
Well, while we maintain the top line expectation, we increased our outlook for a gross margin, for our EPS and EBITDA, and still expect a very strong free cash flow to flow through. What did change is that relative to our initial expectation at the start of the year is that the industry, we believe, will now decline mid-single digit. But the fundamentals are strong. We do expect an accelerated growth rate in the fourth quarter and significant expansion in gross margin compared to the prior year, and for consumer demand to be positive for Mattel in the holiday season, in the fourth quarter and the full year. So we are performing strongly. We're heading into the fourth quarter, seeing stronger support from retailer, more shelf space, more representation in major holiday catalogs, and overall a strong position with a very broad-based offering of products across play patterns, price points, and we believe we're very well positioned competitively.
So just to follow up there, the $125 million that you put out there, the estimate from the Barbie movie and related products, would you say it might be even conservative a little bit, Enon?
Well, we did say it's at least $125 million of revenue at 60% operating income margin. But the takeaway from this is that this is one movie in 1 year. And as we continue mm-hmm. to scale our strategy and have more movies, more executions, not just in film, but also in television, in location-based entertainment, theme parks, consumer products, digital experiences, music, and other verticals, in some cases that are actually bigger than the toy industry, we believe that we have an opportunity to capture significant value from our franchises. And we're not saying that every movie will be as successful as Barbie,
yeah.
But we absolutely believe that in the aggregate, there's a meaningful opportunity for us.
Well, let's go there. And I've got to say, you know, I remember when we started talking to you, or it was in the early days of the Barbie movie, or you started filming. So it was kind of fun to be along for that process. But it was a movie that made us laugh, made us cry. And like I said, it appealed to a lot of different ages, which was pretty, pretty wild. So what are the key brands that you think have life beyond a kid's toy chest and that you think we should be all kind of waiting for, I don't know whether it's 6 months, 12 months, the next couple of years that are going to be brought to life in different ways?
Well, look, the vision of Mattel Films is to collaborate with leading filmmakers to create standout quality movies based on our iconic brands that will resonate in culture and appeal to global audiences. And the Barbie movie, and I'm glad you enjoyed it as much as you did, is a clear showcase.
It did.
And we have,
you brought me back to the theater for the first time.
Well, I'd love to hear that. And we have 14 other movies in development right now. Different demographics, different genres. We have Hot Wheels in development with J.J. Abrams at Warner Brothers. Matchbox in development with Skydance, which, as you know, produced the Mission Impossible movie that did mm-hmm. very well, and Top Gun. We have a movie in development with Vin Diesel around Rock and Stock and Robot, Polly Pocket mm-hmm. with Lena Dunham and Lily Collins. We have Wishbone in development with Pete Farley, Major Matt Mason with Tom Hanks as star, Thomas the Tank with Mark Forster as director, and the list goes on and on. So we really...
Well, you know, it's very good that you're so close to Hollywood out there. Yeah, it's good that you're so close to Hollywood out there in El Segundo. Hey, we only have about 30 seconds left. I'd love to hear comments on the consumer going into the holiday season. Are you seeing signs of weakness in the consumer?
Well, we expect a strong holiday season for Mattel. We believe our retail partners and the industry as a whole is well prepared for this season. And we're very excited to be able to cater consumers of all ages with a great product in the holiday.
I'm going to get yelled at, but I'm going to ask 20 seconds. What's the hot toy for Christmas and the holidays and for Hanukkah? What is the hot toy?
Well, anything Barbie is a hot toy, especially even before the holiday for the Spirit Halloween Barbie costume. Watch out for that. But of course, Hot Wheels is always a winner. The basic car assortment and the five car pack assortment. And look out for the Monster High $4 assortment and Uno. That will be hot selling toys for the holiday season.
God, you're speaking my language. I love Uno and I love Barbie. Enon Kreiz, thank you so much. Truly, your friends and your family are on our minds and in our thoughts. Chairman and CEO of Mattel.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Whirlpool and I have spent the last 75 years becoming laundry experts, but now they're making it easy for everybody.
I'm making your world a little easier.
All right, who doesn't love a vintage commercial? Whirlpool, of course, and they are front and center today. We're watching the share price down about 14% here. What we love about these kinds of companies is they can tell us so much about what's going on, certainly in the minds of the U.S. consumer and what's going on in the U.S. economy. And this is a great conversation, especially, Tim, if you think about it, on a day where we got GDP, we expected it to be hot, and it came in even hotter than expected.
In fact, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, just in the last couple of hours, telling Bloomberg exclusively that the surge that we're seeing in longer-term bond yields in recent months, that's a reflection of the strong U.S. economy not of a jump in government borrowing driven by that widening fiscal deficit.
All right, so good to know. And that GDP report for the third quarter, it was fueled by a surge in consumer spending. So let's get to our guest, Whirlpool Corporation, Mark Bitzer. He is with us. He is chairman, he is president and CEO of Whirlpool. And he joins us on Zoom from Benton Harbor, Michigan. Mark, it is good to have you back with us. Your company, you came out and you trimmed your full year profit outlook amid an uptick in promotions. Investors noticed, and the stock is down the most and to the lowest since 2020. So investors definitely, you know, are upset about what they heard from you guys. First of all, let's take the big picture. What's it like operating in today's environment right now?
Yeah, first of all, Carolyn, and thanks for having me back on the show. I mean, what we basically communicate today is a third quarter, which I would still describe as pretty solid results. That we, year over year, we grew our business. We hadn't grown our business for six quarters in a row, and now we grew our business, more than 3% revenue growth. We expanded market share, and year over year, we expanded our margin by about 100 basis points. But yes, we trimmed our forecast, technically not on the ongoing EPS, because we also had some tax benefits, but we, as opposed to 7.75 EBIT margin, we lowered it to 6.25 to 6.5. So that is trimming the EBIT margin, and the market reacted. You could, in many ways, argue probably overreacted, but it is what it is. But I think that's essentially what happened. The underlying results, which we had, I would still consider very solid, in particular compared to the pre-COVID levels, and also compared to Q2, where we essentially went sideways. But in all transparency, we expected our margins to continue to improve. And instead of that, we basically moved sideways. And I think that's what we see today, a lot of reactions out there. Underneath that, and that's probably getting to your broader question about the consumer. You know, the consumer right now in our industry, we see strong replacement demand, i.e. products break down and you have more appliance usage post-COVID. But the discretionary side of a consumer, which is so much driven by consumer confidence, that is the soft part of a business. That is also the inherently more attractive part of a business because it typically comes with higher margins and higher mix. So we see right now a pretty heavy shift of consumer spending towards the replacement side and lesser to a big discretionary purchase.
That's interesting. And that makes sense given, you know, what else we're hearing with the economy, Mark. Where else are you seeing when it comes to the consumer in the U.S., weakness when it comes to consumer spending? Is there certain categories that you can outline for us where you're seeing weakness? Are there geographies? Is it the higher end consumer that's actually struggling more than a consumer, you know, in the middle or lower end? Tell us what you're learning and what you're seeing.
Yeah, and again, it comes back to my early comment about replacement demand. You know, a replacement demand, just put yourself in consumer shoes. If you have a washer or refrigerator breaking down, you want to have it replaced with 2 days. You don't do the big shopping around and the mix up. You want to replace. So that is just a one-on-one sale, which, again, is typically not a very mix or margin-attractive business. The discretionary side, where people plan for a new kitchen or remodel a house, is the soft part right now. And that's the much richer part of that. So in general terms, you could say, yeah, there's a little bit of a trading down on the consumer landscape. There's a segment of, call it the premium consumer, which is pretty resilient, but it's kind of a big mass in between where you just don't see trading up. If at all right now, you just see more trading down, coupled with, you know, a promotional environment, which we described as return back to pre-COVID levels.
Well, as a consumer, I'm saying, yay, promotions, Mark. I'm going to be quite honest with you. But it does say something to kind of move the needle, right? To get consumers kind of off the thinking area into the actual, you know, buying of something. So how aggressive are your promotions? And are you anticipating that in terms of maybe some weakness and the need for promotions that this continues into well into 2024?
Yeah, and in the earnings call, what we refer to is we consider the promotion environment as having normalized, i.e. call it past tense, okay, which also implies we expect it stabilized going forward. So in terms of the depth or the duration of promotion, this is not any different from pre-COVID. And frankly, it is something which we expected, but it happened and occurred maybe 1 or 2 quarters earlier than we originally anticipated. And that again comes fully back to the discretionary side of the demand, post mortgage rate increases, post all these horrible world news messages that tumbled pretty much, call it in Q2. And consumer confidence ultimately drove that lower discretionary demand, which in turn drove a higher promotional intensity in the environment.
What about the other part of your business, the part about workers, attracting and retaining talent, costs that you have in terms of buying the equipment necessary to build these machines? How are wages for Whirlpool workers right now? Are they up year over year?
Yeah, so first of all, to put it in a broader context, as you know, over the last 3 years, we were not only concerned about cost, we were also concerned about resilience and the strength of our supply chain. The latter part, we basically have, I would say, pretty much fully resolved. Our supply chain is intact. We don't have major availability issues, so that make a check mark behind it. On the cost side, over the last couple of years, we saw the biggest increase of costs on basically raw material and transport. Transport has come down quite a bit, and raw materials are starting to trend down, and that is a favorable trend which we observe, particularly the second half of this year, and we also expect into next year. Well, wage side, and again, that is more driven by of our U.S. factories. One is unionized, the other ones are non-unionized. We basically have every year wage adjustment, and we, in face of a labor shortage, in particular in 21 and 22, we did already fairly significant moves on that wage side. So I would say this year we're not confronted with a massive wage increase. We still, of course, do year-over-year increases, and that kind of helps us dealing with a labor shortage. And right now, I would say across the board, maybe with some fewer region exception, we're pretty well staffed, and the labor shortage is a lot less of an issue than it was, for example, 2 years ago.
Hey, Mark, so what do you make of when we get the retail sales numbers that come out and it shows a really strong consumer, and which kind of surprises everybody because we keep talking about student loan payments or car payments that are going to slow down the consumer? I see what you said about replacement versus discretionary, but does that retail sales data sometimes surprise you? Do you, when people say resilient consumer, does it kind of, you say, well, resilient, but maybe not so much?
Yeah, I mean, Carol, I mean, I would say, I think you need to move from a headline into the details. And yeah, the consumer spending, and that's confirmed. The question is on what is the consumer spending? And we saw there's a lot of spending on services, restaurant costs have gone up, travel has gone up quite a bit. Our part of a business, consumer durable, and again, I'm talking now the discretionary side, not the replacement side. For most families, buying a washing machine or remodeling kitchen is a very significant part of their disposable income. You only do this expenditure if you have confidence in your economic future and the broader environment. And consumer confidence, and you can look at whatever index, that is the one which kind of, call it April, May, dropped off pretty sharply. So yes, I do see the overall consumer spending. I think when durable categories, it's a slightly different picture. They're just on the long-term big disposable items or big ticket items, there's some reluctance on the discretionary side. Again, replacement side is very solid, but on the discretionary side is soft.
Do you guys talk a lot about a recession coming? You know, it's been, you know, coming for 2 years. And some would say, listen, we've already had, you know, certain parts of the market have seen, you know, or certain parts of our economy have seen it. But what's your best guess? As someone who runs a company, you've seen so many different, you know, we've gone through a very tough market cycle, certainly coming off the pandemic that was bad. And then it was actually pretty good. People were doing things, especially on their homes. So do you think a recession is likely in the United States, your biggest market here, certainly by revenue?
Yeah, Carol, first of all, I would start with a caveat. There's probably a lot more people more competent about that subject than I am. So it's the way I would look at it, our company in many ways is a canary in the coal mine. We see certain trends earlier. What I mean with that, we saw the cost inflation in our business a lot earlier than most companies saw it. The same time, we saw the beginning of a cost deflation a little bit earlier, and we probably also see the kind of a normalized consumer promotion environment a little bit earlier. So most of what the broad economy sees, we tend to see maybe call it 3 to 6 months earlier. With that in mind, you know, it's kind of, I think broader terms, the US economy is more resilient than most people thought. So from that perspective, I personally do not see a scenario for a deep recession. Could there be something shallow? Yes. I think the key element will be going forward too is, you know, when will the Fed signal kind of a stabilization of a plateauing of the interest rates? That is a big element. And then, of course, what is a little bit more difficult to answer, when do you when do all these horrible world news become a little bit more less, or are we getting numb against it? So that's the consumer confidence part of it. But again, from a person perspective, we don't expect a big boom, but we don't expect the scenario for deep recession. We're prepared to very small, modest growth in our industry, but we're also prepared to deal with a shallow recession. Mm.
Mark, on that subject of everything that's happening around the world, our focus certainly...
Not numb.
No, yeah. And our focus certainly on the Middle East in addition to other parts of the world. But there's also the business side of this, which is oil prices. And I'm wondering how you're watching energy markets, how you're watching oil prices. And if we do see a spike in oil prices, what that does to your business.
Yeah. And then let me be... Maybe a radio call is maybe not the perfect forum to comment on this horrific attacks and the subsequent human tragedy coming out of this one. So it's kind of difficult to move from that to the economic impact. Having said that, of course, there is, you know, the entire Middle East situation, if it would further escalate, has some risk on the oil prices. Again, there's a big if it further escalates in an uncontrolled manner. As you've seen the last 2 days, the oil price from initial spike, they came down a little bit. And right now in our internal forecast, but again, there's people who probably know a lot more about this, we expect also stabilization, a sideways move of the oil. But it's a lot depends on, will there be stability in what is an extremely difficult Middle East environment?
No, absolutely. Mark, we so appreciate your time. You've always been so generous, and especially throughout the pandemic, coming off of it, trying to help make sense of that cycle. And we really appreciate your time trying to understand what's going on, and really appreciate it. Mark Bitzer, he is Chairman, President, and CEO of Whirlpool, joining us on Zoom from Benton Harbor, Michigan. A great gauge on what's going on in the economy at a time when there is so much heavy news, so much uncertainty. Really appreciate it. Lots more to come right here on Business Week.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Today is a gift, though, to Schwab, because this is where we find ourselves at Impact 2023. There's so much going on, a good reason why investors are amazed that something hasn't broken in the economy yet, because the last time U.S. government bond yields climbed so far so fast, the nation plunged into back-to-back recession. So that is part of kind of our backdrop. Let's get to it, though. We are here in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Convention Center at Schwab Impact 2023. And with us is Rick Worster. He's president of Charles Schwab. I want to say thank you for joining us, but thank you for having us.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's delightful to be here.
It's great to have you here in a day where I kind of laughed with you. It's a shame nothing's going on, but it's a really interesting environment. Geopolitically, obviously, we're, you know, front and center, watching what's going on around the world, but also within the investment environment. How do you make sense, you and your team back at Schwab, about kind of how to prioritize what investors are going to care most about and what's going to impact your world specifically?
Sure. Well, certainly, when we think about the global events, the first thing I think about is the human suffering and the difficulties that a lot of people have had to endure recently. From a market standpoint, we want, you know, that volatility can be challenging to clients. And one of the things that we say in an environment like this is seek out an advisor. And we're sitting here, of course, at our 33rd annual Impact Conference for advisors. And they help clients thrive through environments like this. So it's a challenging environment for the world. Certainly it creates uncertainty and some volatility. But I think advisors can help a lot of our clients through periods like this.
What are you hearing from advisors right now about the questions that their clients have? I mean, we're not only in a challenging world for financial markets, but we're in a challenging world for advisors. There are robo-advisors. I mean, Schwab has its own robo-advisor with Schwab Intelligent Portfolio. What are you hearing from these people whose businesses are being challenged right now?
Well, the thing I would say about the advisor market is that there's a bull market for advice. More and more clients, because of everything that's going on in the world, because of what's happening in markets, because people are trying to integrate markets into taxes and their trusts, their estates, passing wealth along, there is a bull market for help and guidance. And so it's a market in which advisors are thriving and the area is really growing.
Rick, what's the most interesting demographic in terms of the investing public right now for you guys?
Well, to me, it's got to be the baby boomers. The baby boomers have amassed a lot of wealth, and more are retiring every day. And they want that help and guidance to help them get through retirement and navigate all the things in front of them. So to me, that's the most interesting demographic. But at Schwab, we want to meet the needs of every demographic, whether it's a young investor, a baby boomer. We need to be exceptional at meeting the needs of all of those different demographics.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, right, for like a younger investor. We talk a lot about, we had a guest on this past week of just, you know, trying to assess, are we in a recession? And you know, while technically the numbers that we've got growth in the U.S., you know, strong consumer spending numbers still, retail sales numbers.
Employment is strong.
Employment is strong. Having said that, she said, you know, I'm coming from Wisconsin. Again, somebody who manages money. She said, yep, they're working. But folks can't buy a home because they can't afford it with the mortgage rates. They've got $1,000 a month car payments. So they, in essence, feel like it's a recession for them. So I'm just curious, from your people who want to invest with you guys and work on your platforms, you know, what is it that they're doing? Looking to save money, conserve principal, or be more aggressive in this environment because they see some opportunities amid the volatility?
Well, first, to the first part of the question, there's no question this environment has been difficult for investors and difficult for people trying to live in the world. There's been a lot of inflation. The you know, the Fed has raised interest rates dramatically and quickly, but that was after letting inflation run a little bit. And so it has squeezed individuals. At the same time, markets are not that far away, particularly the S&P or the NASDAQ, not far away from all-time highs. So there is a lot of wealth being created along the way. And from our perspective, we're here to serve all investors. Our goal is to help clients navigate their financial life, to make them better off and help them get to where they want to be.
But do they want to be more conservative in this environment? Like, I'm just curious, in an environment where we talk, you know, a money market pays you, right, you know what everybody keeps saying.
More than 5%.
Why not put it there, right, without the risk? Yeah, I'm just curious what you're seeing in terms of those trends.
Yeah, I would say that the call volumes on our fixed income line have gone up 10 times what they were about 18 months ago. So there's no question that there's a lot of interest in yield right now. And why not? You can get a 2.5% real yield on the 20-year now. And I think you have to go back quite a while before that was the case.
Kind of folds perfectly into my next question, which is about the business and about cash in the business. Schwab recently reported earnings, deposits down 28% in the third quarter. It was better than analysts' forecast. Still, though, a drop of more than $284 billion. How much money do you see staying in the Schwab ecosystem right now, even if, you know, cash sweep is occurring, but people can get, you know, more than 5% in money markets?
Well, what I would say is we want clients to do the right thing for them in their situation. We bring all, you know, the clients leave cash in their accounts. We leave it there until we know what they want to do with it. And so they make a decision that they want more yield. They should go and do that. So the money leaving our bank, it's staying at Schwab. It's going and buying government bonds, or it's going into a money market fund. But that money is staying at Schwab, and it's going to places where it can earn higher yield.
Then why were deposits down so much if it's staying at Schwab?
Because it's coming out of our bank and finding its way into higher yielding money market funds or fixed income investments. And that's exactly what we would want for clients. It's not the best thing for our profits, but we want the best thing that's for our clients. And so that money movement is healthy for our clients.
Right. Banking key to revenue, right? We know that, right, from the last earnings report. Is money still continuing to come out of that unit?
Well, what I would say is that if you think about what's happening, clients are looking at, you know, if you went back to when interest rates were quite low, they would have a lot of cash in their portfolios. And they would say, there's no need to move this cash. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to leave it here. It's going to earn zero here. It's going to earn zero anywhere else. As the Fed has lifted interest rates and yields are now more attractive, people have looked at their balances and said, well, gosh, why would I leave it here earning less unless they need it to transact or they know they're going to spend it on something. But for the portion of their cash that they know is longer term cash, they can get more yield somewhere else. So it's moved. And I would just wrap up by saying, we think a lot of the movements have occurred because that yield's been high for a while. So people have made that transition, and we're starting to see a strong deceleration of the pace of cash realignment.
So still coming out, but at a slower pace.
Much slower pace. In fact, last month was the first month where in our bank sweep, we saw a positive growth in banks. So more money coming into the bank than leaving the bank for the first time in a while. So From a business standpoint, that's positive. But again, what we want is clients to find the right investment for them.
Does it make you nervous, though, as we get ready for a GDP report that's backward-looking, mind you, another read on inflation, that in terms of what that could mean for monetary policy? We do think we're getting close to a peak in rates, but nonetheless, whether, again, if we see signs of inflation, if we see more signs of growth, whether or not that means ultimately you're going to see more money coming out because the money markets just kind of get more and more attractive.
Yeah, it could be. We're back in one of these cycles where bad news is good news. You know, I feel like we might be back in that because good news may lead to a higher rate environment. That could be, you know, it could hurt the economy, certainly.
Okay.
So, what about creating new products that help people keep their cash at Schwab? I'm wondering, there are so many high yield accounts available at other financial institutions right now. What are the conversations happening behind the scenes about creating those sorts of products at Schwab?
Yeah, what I would say is we have all kinds of cash products for clients, and we're not having an issue with cash leaving the firm. We've brought in over $200 billion of net new assets to the firm, and a lot of it has found its way into fixed income or money funds. The issue is just where they're saving it, but it's not leaving the firm. So I think there's no better place and no broader array of fixed income and money funds than we have at Schwab. So certainly we always want to bring out new and relevant products, but we're doing a really nice job today of keeping those clients here at Schwab.
But impacts the top line growth. Will you be
certainly
will you be happy when this 5% rate environment is over?
Well, I don't know. 2.5% real yield, I feel like, you know, that's not a bad deal for savers and investors.
I want to ask you about your tenure so far, right? You came in around 2017, 2018. I'm just thinking about kind of where the world was at that point. Not too shabby, right? And then all of a sudden we move into a Fed starts to raise rates, the pandemic hits. It's a whole other world, yeah. Right? The Fed cuts dramatically. We have the economy, everything just shuts down. And then we see markets bounce back in a big way. I mean, how do you think about kind of our visibility going forward in terms of the market environment? Do we really have a good grasp, or is it hard to considering that trajectory and trying to figure out kind of what happens after a pandemic and all of the stimulus and crazy activity that went on?
Well, we've certainly seen a lot in the last 5 or 6 years, haven't we?
Yeah.
You know, a pandemic.
Your timing was good.
Yeah, all kinds of different market environments. You know, our advice to clients at Schwab is to come up with a plan, stick to that plan, and if you need help, seek the help of an advisor who can help guide you through it. But we believe it's hard to time the markets and to outthink, you know, what's going to happen. Are we going to be in a recession, not in a recession? Of course, we have an opinion on those things, but we're not always right. And we want investors to stay the course, have a plan, stick to it, and work with an advisor if that makes sense for them.
What's your opinion on where we're going?
On the markets?
Yeah.
I mean, I think at some point monetary policy has to lead to a more restrictive economy. But we'll see.
Recession or soft landing?
I am not an economist. I'm not going to make that call. But, you know, listen to Lizanne Saunders or Jeff Kleintop. They do a really nice job of calling the markets and the economy.
As someone who manages, though, and is very part of the C-suite right here, who covers, you know, and runs this company, what's top of mind for you guys, whether it's employees, whether it's cost cutting? What is it?
To me, it's opportunity. We have so much opportunity to delight our clients and make them better off in their financial life. What I worry about at night is, are we doing enough and are we doing it fast enough? I just think we are blessed to have 35 million clients that we serve on a daily basis. And I want to make sure we do everything in our power to make them as well off as they can be.
Can you talk a little bit about customer service? I have, you know, full disclosure, I'm a Schwab client, so I've experienced.
Thank you for your business.
And one thing that is notable, it's like, to me, it's like, Carol, when we talk about American Express, mm-hmm. You call Schwab and a person answers. You call American Express and a person answers. Can you talk about the investments that you make in customer service so people have those interactions just in the last minute that we have?
Yeah, client service is critical to us. It's one of the things that really differentiates Schwab from some of our competitors. We've answered the phone this year on average in less than 30 seconds. I can't get anyone to pick up my phone call in 30 seconds, certainly not my teenage daughter. So
we got to text her.
Yeah, we make it.
So true.
It's really important to us that we answer the phones, that we're there for the clients, and that we're delivering what they need. We are a client-focused business. We only succeed when our clients succeed.
So no worry about AI taking over?
AI is going to be really helpful to all those people answering the phones. I think they're going to make them more efficient. They're going to help them get an answer
to
you.
As an assist.
They're going to help you get an answer more quickly. They're going to help you get a better answer. But they'll be in the background supporting that person you're talking to.
All right. Love to hear that rather than taking over. Rick, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for having us. Rick Worster, he's president, of course, of Charles Schwab, on-site at Schwab Impact. We are just getting started, though, on this Wednesday. Carol Masser along with Tim Stenovic, and you are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow. Did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann. Let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. It's some lighter fare after another jam-packed and very heavy week. Coming up, a conversation with Forward Space founder Kristen Sudeikis, yes, Jason's sister, on building a unique brand in the ultra-competitive group fitness market.
Plus, the CEO of language learning platform Babbel on the trends that you're keeping the company at the front of the pack. And find out where to hit the slopes this winter with the annual Bloomberg Pursuits Ski Special.
I've never seen Tim so happy.
I know, that's a fun one.
All right, we mentioned earlier that we are coming to you from the Schwab Impact 2023 conference in Philadelphia this week. Plenty of talk about the U.S. economy and inflation. And first up this hour, we look at a prime example of rising prices in the auto sector, a $100,000 Jeep SUV.
Bloomberg News auto reporter Gabrielle Coppola writes about the unusual Stellantis offering in the current double issue of the magazine. It's out now on newsstands, it's online, and of course on the Bloomberg Terminal. Gabby and Bloomberg Business Week Assistant Managing Editor Jim Ellis have more.
We've been talking about the affordability issue for a while now, that cars continually go up despite the pandemic, despite the fact that a lot of people seem to be worried about employment, and despite interest rates, which has made financing cars much more expensive than even just a year ago. And so I would have thought that means that anybody who's out there, you know, sort of hawking vehicles was having a hard time doing anything with pricing. And it turns out, in talking to one of our reporters in Detroit, Gabby Coppola, that's not the case. That actually, Jeep has been extremely aggressive at raising prices, and that's been great news for Stellantis, which used to be, as you said, you know, a sort of an also-ran. It's the parent of what used to be Chrysler, and it's part of Fiat Chrysler. And sort of people thought forever that they were sort of behind the guys like GM and Ford. And instead, now they are a profit leader, and they have basically done what I wouldn't have thought was possible, which was to basically raise prices, and people still want you so much more that they're willing to pay not only higher prices, but prices that are going up faster than the overall already supercharged auto market.
So you mentioned Gabby Coppola, and she is with us. She is auto reporter at Bloomberg News. She's there with us in our Detroit bureau. Gabby, come on in on your story. I can't tell you how much we've all been talking about it throughout the day, because we're like, what, $100,000 for Jeep? Help me. Build on what Jim has been saying about the story that you wrote.
The interesting thing about Jeep as a brand is that it's always been like this incredibly coveted thing in the auto industry, because people love their Jeeps. The only other thing you can compare it to in terms of a brand, like a transportation brand that has a real authentic community around it, would be like Harley Davidson or something.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So like, that's always been this great thing. But the question is, well, how do you milk that? You know, how do you make more money off that? And Jeep decided to say, you know, honestly, all of Detroit did, let's get out of these like low margin commodity cars. Let's focus on, you know, the most profitable trucks and SUVs. And Jeep, you know, they've added to their lineup to do that. They added the Gladiator, which is like a Jeep truck, like a midsize truck. And then they did this sort of extension of the brand, which was they brought back the Wagoneer, you know, which is a nameplate people identify with from the past, got a lot of nostalgia, but they made it this super luxury, you know, car that starts out, or, you know, just under $100,000.
That is like mind blowing. But so, yeah. But you write in your story that overall unit sales for the Jeep brand fell 4% in the third quarter, the ninth consecutive quarterly decline. This coming from the company reporting out numbers earlier this month. That can't be good. That's not a good trend line.
That is not a good trend line. And, you know, Jeep will say that they're starting to turn it around and that they're sensitive to this. And, you know, they're also a brand in transition because it is true they discontinued the Cherokee. Which is kind of like, that's the biggest segment, that size SUV, and they basically have a big hole right there. So sure, there's some, you know, temporary things, but I'm not so sure it's just temporary. You know, the most interesting conversation I had reporting the story was with this guy, Alexander Edwards, who's like a brand researcher. And he said the most fascinating things to me about Jeep. You know, when you look at car companies or really any brand, you're thinking about what is that company doing to build equity in that brand. He gave the example of, say, you know, Hyundai has like this warranty, you know, 10 years, whatever it is. You know, we are so confident in our quality. If you buy our car, we're going to deliver that quality to you.
Yeah.
Wrangler brings authenticity, you know, great capability, handling, all that kind of stuff. But he feels like they've been kind of resting on their laurels a bit. And I think that is why you see them, their sales suffering more than others in the industry, because everybody's raised their prices, right? Everybody, we had the chip shortage of the pandemic, but why is the Jeep brand suffering? And there's some interesting kind of psychology brand dynamics going there. That's just really interesting from like a corporate strategy aspect and like a brand strategy aspect. So,
but Gabby, is that the, in the end, is that the price one has to pay to get higher earnings? Is basically to say, maybe I'm not going to think as much about maintaining my volumes and instead, you know, raise prices while I can and basically just work about margins, which makes Wall Street happy, but might not be the best thing longer term for a brand.
Which is so interesting on a moment where we're talking so much about Tesla margins after they report. It's obviously something we all focus on. Come on in, Gabby.
Yeah. No, that's a great point, Carol. Like, Tesla is kind of doing the opposite. they're saying we're going to go. The auto industry, you know, I've talked to a former Chrysler executive who said this funny thing to me. He said, he said, market share is vanity. Profitability is sanity. So this is like the choice that every auto executive, every car company has to make. Do you go for volume or do you go for profit? Then it's kind of like a dial you have to adjust to keep a healthy brand and a healthy company. And I think Jeep has gone very far into the profitability dial. I seriously, in reporting the story, was like, guys, is this the plan? Like, is this on purpose? And they're like, no. Like, they don't like what, obviously they don't like what's happening, and they want to bring it back.
Yeah, nobody likes a downward moving trend line. Come on, like, get real.
Right. So, yeah, you can't say, oh yeah, we don't care. Like, you can't say that. Yeah.
I mean, Gabby, I have to say, I love this story because I was pretty shocked a little over a year ago when I saw the Grand Wagoneer. And, you know, it's funny because my grandparents had one of these Wagoneers back in the day. And like, I have memories of when I was a kid being in this wood paneled like 1980s Wagoneer. It looks nothing like the Grand Wagoneer today. When you approach $91,000 as the base price and get up, you know, easily over $100,000 when you do add-ons, what's the competition on an SUV basis that starts to come in that could pull away potential buyers?
Well, so that segment, you know, it's not like Jeep invented this idea, okay? Like, look at the Cadillac Escalade. That, you know, Ford or has the Lincoln brand, the Lincoln Navigator. They're going up against like a Mercedes G-Wagon. So it's really like Jeep was, you know, the company was trying to get in on some of that. They're late to the party. They have, you know, the merger happened. They have more resources. They wanted to say, why are we leaving this money on the table? Let's do this. The question is, they put it under the Jeep brand because that is their most popular, right? That was kind of the easy way to go. The point that Alexander Edwards made was that the right place to put a vehicle like that? Because it has to live in the same tent with the Wrangler, with the people who are all about authenticity, all about realness, all about, you know, get out there in the woods or on an off-road trail and, you know, screw your boss and your crappy job. You go out there with your Wrangler. Like,
you know, it's a Jeep thing.
Yeah, it's a Jeep thing. I mean, I was going through, like, social media looking at, like, Reddit threads of communities around Jeep, and the community is very strong. People put these little rubber ducks on their cars. You see, I see people at Jeep will have a bunch of rubber ducks on the, it's like this kindness, it's this community, it's like we're all the same tribe kind of thing. Again, it's like a group of Harley, and it transcends class. Right? Like, I think it's the same with Harley Davidson.
One of the things that really surprised...
Oh. Gabby, Stellantis is calling, and they'd like you to write their next commercial for Jeep, because that was, like, priceless. Anyway, Jim, go ahead.
Gabby, one of the things that I found really interesting in your story was that even though, you know, Jeep is trying to sort of deal with this issue by coming out with some lower-priced offerings... The starting price, the price that we all see on websites and whatever, is not what people pay for a Wrangler, for example. I mean, there are just, it's sort of like a Chinese menu. There's so many add-ons here that really make these cars very expensive.
That's exactly right. So when they say, oh, but we have an entry-level two-door ragtop Wrangler for only $32,000, you know, that is very, very basic. And the stuff you're going to, I mean, Jim and I were going through some of these options last night, and we were putting the story together. You know, oh, okay, you want to have a color other than white on your Wrangler? Okay, that's another, you know, $600. You know, the stuff, you know, and it's fine. The Wrangler is a toy. It's a big toy for people.
That was Bloomberg News auto reporter Gabrielle Coppola and Bloomberg Businessweek assistant managing editor Jim Ellis.
As we mentioned, and as you can probably hear from the background, this week we broadcast from the Schwab Impact 2023 conference in Philadelphia. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Coming up, creating a new niche in the health and wellness space with the CEO of New York City's Forward Space, Kristin Sudeikis. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, the fitness market, a few stats to throw out at you from various research groups. The virtual fitness market to be worth about $106.4 billion by 2030. And then you got gym membership, that market to reach over $70 billion globally by 2032. People work. You love working out.
I do. Yeah, when I can certainly find the time, it's good for us. We have to do it as people. I mean, this is like essential stuff. In general, the fitness sector roared back after being devastated by the pandemic. It also changed a lot during the pandemic.
Totally.
With the virtual stuff, people working out at home. It continues to provide different offerings as a way to work out. Enter Forward Space, Carol, about 5 years ago. That was back in 2018.
And great to have with us on Zoom in New York, Kristin Sudeikis. She's founder, CEO, and creative director of Forward Space. Kristin, so great to have you here on Bloomberg Business Week. First of all, how are you? And tell us about your world in Forward Space and how it all came to be.
Thank you for having me. How did it come to be? Human connection, very much in the business of human connection by way of movement and music. So I've been doing that as a choreographer and artistic director for a lot of my life, and started to really notice a high demand and high just requests of me personally. Where can I just go move, go dance, connect myself? And there just wasn't quite a space that merged the serious side of dance, technical side of dance, the social side of dance that's so essential to human connection and to what we're needing as social beings, you know, to be in a room together. The resurgence of how potent that is, that people want to be in a room with other people working out and not just at home. And then the sweat side, which is the cardio workout side. So it bridges the three together, the serious side of dance or this technical side that a lot of people really want the training of how can I be better at dancing, but in an accessible, non-intimidating way. The social side, which is, you know, people are probably out doing somewhere right now. And then the sweat side, where people could get a workout in, not just for their bodies, but for their minds and their emotional health and their energetic health.
What's interesting, and we talked over the summer, you know, I am from a large family. We love to dance, whether it's a wedding, whatever. It's like, it's such a great workout, but, you know, throw some music on and we're like all over the place.
I want to go to one of these weddings and see the Masser clan do their thing.
But it sounds like that's what, you know, you've really kind of, you know, tapped into something of, you know, you throw on some great music, you post your playlist, you curate them,
yeah.
And then you, though, combine it with a workout. Like, it's just, I can get it.
Yes, yes. And the human connection part of it all, you know, I mean, that's really the genesis of it. Is creating a space where people could connect, not just to others, first to themselves, then to those around them, be it at a wedding, that same feeling where you meet people on the dance floor, but then also the greater world around us, mm-hmm. in that order again and again and again, in a dark room. I should share that part because we keep the lights very low because many people are very, very nervous coming in. They have wanted a space to try to dance or use some there's one class that's a fire class. So there's free weights and a lot of sculpting exercises with little mini dance breaks in between. And that's for people that are all the way backed up, you know, wallflower style. Yes.
So you guys have an actual physical space in Soho here in New York, but you can also do this virtually. How do you recreate virtually what you create in the space in Soho? How do you actually do that?
Yeah. Great question. It's similar to what we're doing right here, right now. While we're not in the same room, it feels different, yet I can feel connected to you all. It to create a precise portal going through the camera so that people receive the information in their homes. I think there's something really special about the fact that we have now expanded into the virtual and the many people that are doing it that also have a physical space, those of us that have the both and, because people either come to our home, if you will, in Soho, and then we also have the opportunity to be in people's homes, you know? And that's a key element I talk about when we're getting ready to film and things like that. It's to just take a moment and know that we're entering their space now. And so, but how do you do it where it still feels electric? And it's in the delivery, it's in the professionalism, it's in the training of it all, and making it look effortless, and the music.
You know, it's really kind of interesting. I love the workout space, and we've covered it a lot here at Bloomberg and certainly at Bloomberg Business Week, and it really has taken off in so many different iterations. How do you think about differentiating yourself? I mean, you've laid it out, but it's a competitive field. I'm just curious if that's top of mind, that understand that you're competing for people's time, how they want to work out. I get the social component, but how do you think about that? Because you do think about growing your business and throw in some business metrics, because we are curious about how much the business has grown in the past 5 years.
Sure. 2023 alone, in our one flagship space, we've seen 2,300 new clients.
Wow. Okay.
And we have very, very minimal, I'm just to give you, kind of makes my chest still drop a bit, because it's just affirming the demand that I saw traveling in the country and outside of the country, creating dance concepts. But that's just in our Soho space, in the physical space, and absolutely to the expansion. And do I worry about the competition? Absolutely no. Because this is the grace of being a working dancer and choreographer, first and foremost, you know, professionally starting to teach when I was 13, I was given the opportunity to do so. And even moving to New York from Kansas City, people would say, are you worried about the competition, you know, in the arts and things? And no, I was driven by the connection and how it shifts people's world individually and collectively. So the competition, like, you know, kind of fires me up. I'm good to go with all that.
As you know, we are Bloomberg. So I am curious about, you know, are you profitable? What's the plan? Like, how do you want to grow the business? Do you want to stay private? I'm just curious, because you do have investors, you know, 8VC, you've got Able Partners, you've got G9 Ventures, you've got a bunch of people who've definitely ponied up money to back you.
They did. And brilliant people. And we are very intentional with who we said yes to being a part of this with Forward Space. How do we plan to expand? Soho's our flagship space. We'll continue to do activations. We've done them in London and out east in the Hamptons for 5-6 weeks. We've got our eyes on the Upper East Side, West Hollywood, LA. So these are the other physical spaces that will open. Chicago's in the mix.
Yeah.
And then partnerships, brand partnerships has been one of the large lanes. You know, if you think of Forward Space, obviously in the center here, we've got our virtual, our flagship space, our varying spaces that will open around 10 or 12 in the next 5 years. And then the brand partnerships. We've done things with a number of notable brands, large brands. And so building those relationships out further, 6K relationships, you know, 6K.
What about potentially franchising like Orange Theory has done?
Right. I don't think we'll go that route. And that was early on when we were first building out the plan and doing, I was doing the first round of investment, a non-convertible, for good convertible note. And so in the convertible note, that was a large conversation I had. And a few of our key investors, we had some really strong meetings about knowing this will explode in all the ways, wanting to be intentional with it and to not, some of them had taken the franchise route and learned, and we don't think that would be the route for Forward Space. It's not an absolute no, but it's likely not.
Kristen, really quickly, 30 seconds. Your brother is Jason Sudeikis. So did you ever give him advice on Ted Lasso? Does he ever give you advice on a playlist? And just quickly.
Oh, gosh. I mean, we're passing music back all the time and talking life and talking all the things. But I mean, I never gave him advice on his body of work, his show. I called the body of work that's been exhaled, that's brought such joy, and talk about connection, yeah. Human connection. But I mean, he's an amazing big, he's an older brother, you know, my only brother, very close, and feel very lucky to talk music and playlists and life and all these things.
Well, listen, so much fun. Next time, come join us. We'd love to have you in studio. Come back and we'll talk a little bit more about the business too.
Do some dancing.
Yeah, I do some dancing. Kristen Sudeikis, she's founder, CEO, and creative director of Forward Space.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Time now for a bit of luxury with our friends from Bloomberg Pursuits. And this week's issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine includes the long-awaited return of the annual ski special. Tim, it's almost ski season, and you're pretty excited.
I'm excited, but, you know, thinking back to my glory days of living in the mountains after college, skiing is just not the same when you have two kids and, you know, live in New York City.
What skiing?
There are places that will take them all day. It's just only, so you have to, you know that.
Yeah, it's only $500
Club
a kid,
Med.
Though, right? Club Med, that's true.
It's true. All right,
no, you guys skiing are, at Club Med, though.
You guys are hearing
French Alps.
Okay,
you guys
there we
are
go.
Hearing the voices of Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser and Bloomberg News Travel czar Nikki Eckstein. So let's get into it. All right, I always like to ask, how do you guys approach this? Like, yeah, I mean, there's people who have kids, there's people who, like, so how did you approach it this time around?
Well, we do this every year, and Nikki and I are both skiers, so we love working on this section. And what we try to do is combine news, like stuff that you may not know about, so developments in hotels or resorts, new ski terrain, along with service. So what's some of the gear you might need? Where are some of the places you might want to stay? Like news plus fun.
I was going to say, I think we're like very much guided by our own hearts, right? Since we care about this industry, we always try to feature the things that are really exciting to us because we think that that's what will excite other people too.
Well, speaking of the industry, it's undergone some serious consolidation over the last decade or so, Nikki. When we think about independent ski resorts, we think about those that aren't owned by the big players, Vail Resorts and Alterra, which own almost half the ski areas here in the U.S., and they're continuing to buy more. You dedicate a big section of this issue to what you call the independent resorts.
Yeah, you know, we're thinking about the trends for the year ahead, and this is something where for the last, I don't know, 10 years maybe, we've been seeing the demise of independent resorts. They all get scooped up by the corporate companies that strip them of character and flavor and make them, you know, available to people on Epic Passes and so on and so forth, which is its own service. But this year, we're seeing something different. We're seeing independent mountains come into their own. Many of them are actually being acquired by major entrepreneurs and people from the finance world, not from the ski industry itself.
I have to say, I love this. I had no idea. And I feel like for years, we're like, isn't this great? These like big corporate groups creating these passes where you can scale these different places.
It helps users for sure.
Right? Okay. So, but talk to us about the independents here, Chris, and who's doing some of the, who's getting involved, because they are names that certainly our audience is going to know.
Yeah, so with like a lot of things that you want to survive and love, sometimes it does require, like media, for example, it does require a billionaire to come in and invest.
Well said.
And in some of these places, that's exactly what happened. So Reed Hastings, who is the co-founder of Netflix, who we all know, came in and bought Powder Mountain. And has announced $100 million in commitment to improving it. And that's the kind of thing that is going to keep Powder Mountain independent. And it's going to, he says, he's going to keep the appeal that mountain has for the current users and maybe bring in some new people.
What's interesting is about how he found it. So it sounds like he found this mountain after being kind of frustrated by some of the more populated. And it sounds like he wants to keep it that way for himself, right, as well as others.
So the story is that he lived in Park City. He had a house there. He had his kids were living there. You know, they all would go skiing as a family in Park City all the time. And one day it dumped snow. He piled his family into the car, was like, let's all go powder chasing at Park City. And they get to the mountain and it's all been packed over. He says it was like skiing on a sugar cube.
Ants on a sugar cube.
Yeah, that was the exact quote. And so he got fed up and he literally put his family back in the car the same day. He was like, I heard of this place 90 minutes north driving. Let's go. Let's see what happens. They were there by lunchtime at Powder Mountain. And within like weeks, he ends up buying a house there later on. Buying the resort. He wants to preserve it. He wants to preserve his own special place.
I mean, who hasn't gone on vacation somewhere and then decided to buy the entire
resort? And then decided to buy it.
Yeah. All totally the time. I will say, I was surprised to read that about Reed Hastings because, you know, you think, okay, it's Reed Hastings. He's worth more than $4 billion, according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. And he skis just like normal people. Like, I thought he'd be, you know, helicopter skiing and, you know, going to these resorts all over the world. But I guess he piles the kids in the car and does his thing.
And bought his own resort.
And bought a resort.
Billionaires, they're just like us. Yeah.
The other one who got involved, which I thought was interesting, was a former CEO of Citigroup.
Yeah, Mike Corbett.
Yeah, so Jackson Hole is another one. So this is another funny story where quite a few years ago, a bunch of people who make these like indie ski videos out of Jackson Hole posted something saying that Vail had bought Jackson Hole. And the entire internet goes aflame saying, not my mountain.
April Fools.
April Fools. It was a literal April Fools. But the family that owned that resort, the Kemmerer family, decided, you know, we have to take this seriously. We're not going to sell Jackson Hole unless it's to another independent entity. And they spent years and years debating whether they should keep it, sell it after they proudly built it up to what it is now. And finally, after the pandemic, the Kemmerer family decided maybe now is the time to back out. They approached Mike Corbett.
Love it.
And he said yes. And as of August, the resort has new ownership. I don't think it had been previously reported, actually, at least the terms of the deal. So we are very happy to share that.
I feel like it's a story
that
we would have done as like one of our, you know, like, hey, did you see this story? Because it's just kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Like these big names. I just want to just real quickly do Wyndham. I had a sister who taught on Wyndham for a long time. It was such a family mountain.
Yes.
But it's really gone a makeover.
I love that you know it. I used to ski there a lot too, and people have been really up in arms in recent years because in order to make the economics of that mountain work, the day passes have gone as high as $175 a day, which for East Coast skiing is ludicrous.
Right.
But now the proposition is that the family that owns Blackberry Farm in Tennessee, an incredible culinary-driven five-star super luxe resort, has taken over Wyndham along with another family, and they are hoping to bring that same sensibility of like four seasons, great food, you know, après ski culture.
Wait, the $175,000 initiation fee?
Yeah.
I
mean, there's a little aspect of it that's a little, right?
Skiing is still going to be open to the public.
Okay.
There has been uproar because they're turning it into a members club as well, but skiing will remain open to the public.
Okay, I'm just going to say, you know, and I think it's like Sesame Street, one of these things does not belong. Wyndham, along with Jackson Hole and Powder Mountain.
Hey.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh,
but
you're not wrong.
Nikki knows what I'm talking about.
It's a crazy number. No, it is a crazy number. And, you know, we're not there yet. Like, they're just starting this now. So what they're trying to do is really build up the amenities, make it like feel maybe as posh as a Yellowstone Club, Silo Ridge, but not you don't have to buy a house to be there. So we don't really know what they're going to offer to try to make that seem valuable.
Make it year-round too, right?
Yeah, and they're talking about opening a property in the Catskills as well for summertime. So it could really be an asset to New Yorkers who want that kind of Blackberry Farm experience closer to home.
All right, I don't ski as much as you guys. I used to ski, but I don't as much. So I kind of got into some of the gear. Can I be quite honest? Let's talk about the gear, Chris.
So, you know, when you go backcountry skiing, especially if you're going heli skiing, you need to take certain things with you in case there's an avalanche. And so you have to have a beacon, a shovel, a probe so people can track where you are.
Yeah.
But now there's a lot of stuff that takes that safety to the next level. This is not something that I personally do. So I also read this and was like, yeah, give me all of this.
Do any of you do this?
I do. I have an Avalung in my closet.
You do?
Yeah, but the technology, it's interesting, is about 15 years old. And this the product that I have is a backpack with like a breathability thing built into it, it's a lot different than what's available now, where you have airbags, you have assisted breathing vests. It's essential stuff if you're going into the backcountry, Nikki.
I wouldn't know, but I'm really glad to hear this because I find this to be so terrifying and I want people to stay safe.
Anything that has gear that you need to take that has the word lung in it,
pumping oxygen in like a couple minute intervals.
The trick is going with people who know what they're doing. I mean, these are people who know how to read snow and understand where it's safe to ski and where it's not safe to ski.
Some of this gear.
And one of the things that I think is actually really cool about this is that there's this app. And, you know, when we were working on the story, Chris was really skeptical about this. And we really had to dig in and figure out what the deal was. But there's this app that uses LiDAR mapping technology, which basically scans the Earth's surface for evenness of snowpack, for density, for tree cover, for how foot traffic affects the snowpack and the other factors.
Unbelievable.
And uses all that, combines it into historical data to predict which ways down the mountain will have greater avalanche risk than others, also factoring the day's forecast, the day's avalanche forecast, all of it. And it makes predictive recommendations to you.
Really smart. LiDAR, right? It's in the self-driving vehicles.
Yeah, really cool.
I'm just going to say, I want to go to the puffer coats. I'm a little upset you didn't bring any for us to try on because you've done that in the past.
Okay. You would take a Moncler.
That's good feedback.
I would, or a Herno. Hernos are a pretty cool brand. Anything we should know about that?
If you want something that's like so hot that you're like a furnace, Nobis is really the brand for you. We also say Patagonia is, you can't go wrong with Patagonia if you don't want to spend a crazy amount of money.
Guys, thank you so much. Off and running for the new ski season. Our thanks to Bloomberg Pursuit's editor, Chris Rouser.
And of course, Bloomberg News travel czar, Nikki Eckstein. Looking forward to hitting the slopes ASAP. I think I'll go check it out this year. Bring the little guy.
Take the little critters.
Yeah, take the critters.
All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Business Week, guys. Thank you so much. And if you're traveling abroad for your next ski trip or any sort of trip for that matter, you might want to stick around for our next guest, Julie Hansen, U.S. CEO of Babbel, the world's best-selling language learning platform. She stops by next. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We've got with us Julie Hansen. She's U.S. CEO of Babbel. It's a privately held company, and it's a role that she's had since 2017. Julie also, we should note, is the former COO and president at Business Insider. She was there when Axel Springer bought BI in a deal that valued the company for $450 million back in 2015. Julie joins us on Zoom from New York. Julie, good to have you with us this afternoon. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Tim. Thanks, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you with us. Talk to us a little bit about the growth that you've seen on the platform, because I got to tell you, there is no shortage of places where you can go online to learn languages.
True. But we've seen, I mean, Babbel was the originator of the category of online language learning some 17 years ago when it was founded in Germany. And we've seen double-digit growth. Growth really boomed during the pandemic, but then it stayed at very elevated double-digit rates ever since. And we've been able to sustain that growth. And part of what drives it is what you said at the top of the program, that multi-language families are growing in this country, but it's also just become something that's somehow more appealing to do in our culture, and we're benefiting from that.
So Julie, wait, help me out here. You said, obviously, makes sense, right? A boom during the pandemic, right? People were at home, they wanted to learn to knit, learn to make sourdough bread, and learn to speak another language. Like, that's what it was about. And stay healthy, no doubt about that, during the pandemic. But you've held on to those levels of growth as well as subscribers. Are you saying that you've maintained those levels and the gains?
Yeah, I mean, not quite at the pandemic levels, but we've grown double digit ever since the pandemic. So very strong growth. I mean, Babbel is the most sold language learning platform ever. We've sold more than 16 million subscriptions over time. I can't tell you all the reasons why, but it just seems like something about the language learning boom during the pandemic validated that as an activity, and people have stayed with it.
I'm curious, like, how does it work? If you become, you sign on and you become a customer of your services, do you become a repeat customer? Is that what often, or is it all about new customer acquisition?
So interesting, actually. In Europe, especially in Germany, we do see quite a bit of repeat purchases, whether people are coming back to a language after a pause, or often they're like learning the next language, which of course is very impressive.
Yeah.
Who are these people?
who
are learning so many languages?
Over here in the US, we tend to see that people take a pause and then come back. But language learning is, you know, a long-term activity. You can make progress in a short time period, but you don't become fluent without, you know, a considerable long-term effort. So people know that. And that's actually one of the reasons why lifetime subscription is a very popular option.
Talk to me about the strategy here with Babbel in terms of learning and how Babbel teaches in a way that's different from other platforms. And compare with Duolingo. I know Duolingo is a company. It's publicly traded. It's got a market cap of about $6.9 billion. It went public just a couple of years ago. And that one certainly gets a lot of mind share with especially millennials and Gen Z.
Yep. Definitely different learning approaches. You know, at Babbel, we use a lot of learning science and frankly, a lot of AI embedded in the product. But we do believe that human-led teaching, you know, we have something like 150 didactics experts on staff who've created our courses, that we need to marry their knowledge with technology is basically the essence of what we do. We also believe that, you know, you're not going to become perfectly fluent from any app. So that's why we've created other products to support and round out the language learning experience. So it might be we have a bunch of podcasts. I think we're up to 23 different podcasts. But we also have live teacher-led, you know, virtual classes. And those are an important part of, you know, really, we care about learner success. So we believe that to get learners to succeed, you have to combine learning methods. I mean, there's scientific research behind that. It's not just our belief. So it's that combination of human and technology, especially AI, but other technologies too, and the idea of creating a whole surround sound of learning experiences.
It's really interesting. How much of your business is B2B, business to business? I'm always curious about, or is a lot of it just individuals who want to learn a language?
Well, the B2B is the fastest growing segment of our business by far. Mm-hmm. It's the newest compared to the consumer, though. So it's not nearly as big, but growing fast. And those are very interesting use cases. We started that business in Europe. We found, you know, international companies, multinational companies needed help. And then we came to the US and it took a while for the use case to become clear here. But we believe the growth opportunity is massive in the US based on just migration patterns, because often Babbel is brought in for language teaching in situations where there's workplace safety at risk. We have a very diverse group of clients here, from a bunch of MLB teams. Maybe safety isn't quite the thing there. It's excellence. But, you know, down to meat packers, landscapers. I mean, places where language barriers create safety issues. And there's a big opportunity in that.
Talk to me about mobile versus desktop right now. What's the share on mobile?
You know, when I started here, if you can imagine, people actually... there was a lot of desktop usage. That was just 6 years ago. And I thought it was really peculiar, frankly, coming from the US. But now it's we're a mobile app. There are still some people who use the product on their desktop or maybe their iPad. But it's a mobile world.
What does it typically cost for somebody who wants to subscribe or learn a language?
I mean, you can start in the US if you want to just try a one-month subscription for about $15. If you want to subscribe for the year, more like $90. You can pick up a lifetime subscription for, call it $300. So in that range.
And your biggest market or biggest or fastest growing market, is it the US? Just got about 30 seconds left here.
Yes to both. The US was the last one that we found success in, and it took a very dedicated approach, but it's now the biggest market, the fastest growing. You know, it's all about learning Mexican Spanish in the US market. But we teach all of our 14 languages, but that's the popular language here.
Ah, really interesting. Thanks for the insight. Really fascinating. Julie Hansen, US CEO of Babbel, and joining us, of course, on Zoom in New York City.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.